Culture Mobile, an employee initiative of the BMW Group since 2003. The literature podcast of Culture Mobile.
Henry David Thoreau is one of the great American writers. He was born in 1817 and passed away in 1862. He's probably best known for his work Walden, or Life in the Woods. When close to Concord, Massachusetts, he spent more than 2 years in the woods writing about it. A great Bible for the environmentalists up until today, a great pamphlet of self-reliance that has still value when we read it today. There's another text of his that was first the theme of a lecture. It was called Resistance to Civil Government and was based on a talk that he gave in 1848 and was published the year after, now called On the Duty of Civil Disobedience. You know, Henry David Thoreau was fed up with slavery and with the Mexican-American War, so he wrote a text about how he felt as a citizen. And it is one of the greatest texts written in this regard, you know, picked up by many socialists and revolutionaries alike ever since its publication in the middle of the 19th century. Pretty much at the same time that Karl Marx published his Communist Manifesto. It is important to note that Henry David Thoreau was a transcendentalist, a utopian, you know, pretty much going up against the industrial era. And he wasn't alone with that. There's great other writers like Nathaniel Hawthorne, who wrote an entire book about his experience, the Blithedale Romans, his experience, you know, trying to live rather in a community than just, you know, in big cities and thriving in luxury and other things. So it's great that Henry David Thoreau, as a transcendentalist, was part of a movement that was really looking in the middle of the 19th century in the United States for an alternative world, for something where community matters more than, you know, whoever makes the most money or anything like that. So this is something that is of importance when we look at late capitalism today and think of experiments that were going on as early as the middle of the 19th century with the US-American movement of transcendentalism that, of course, was informed by German Romanticism and, you know, pre-socialist utopianism before the French Revolution. So all these things feed off one another, and it is great to see how there's an international movement of sorts, at least of the spirit, where, you know, people read texts from each other. Texts get translated. Translation is what turns literature into world literature. And here we have it, Henry David Thoreau. So I will not read his entire essay, which is absolutely worth reading, and as it's, you know, free to download anywhere online because there's no more copyright to it, I will read just a few excerpts. Henry David Thoreau, On the Duty of Civil Disobedience. I heartily accept the motto, that government is best which governs least, and I should like to see it acted up to more rapidly and systematically. Carried out, it finally amounts to this, which also I believe, that government is best which governs not at all. And when men are prepared for it, that will be the kind of government which they will have. Government is at best but an expedient. But most governments are usually, and all governments are sometimes, inexpedient. The government itself, which is only the mode which the people have chosen to execute their will, is equally liable to be abused and perverted before the people can act through it. I ask for, not at once no government, but at once a better government. Let every man make known what kind of government would command his respect, and that will be one step toward obtaining it. After all, the practical reason why, when the power is once in the hands of the people, a majority are permitted and for a long period continue to rule, is not because they are most likely to be in the right, nor because this seems fairest to the minority, but because they are physically the strongest. But a government in which the majority rule in all cases cannot be based on justice. Can there not be a government in which majorities do not virtually decide right and wrong, but conscience? in which majorities decide only those questions to which the rule of expediency is applicable. Must the citizens ever for a moment, or in the least degree, resign his conscience to the legislator? Why has every man a conscience then? I think that we should be men first and subjects afterward. It is not desirable to cultivate a respect for the law so much as for the right. The only obligation which I have a right to assume is to do at any time what I think right. It is truly enough said that a corporation has no conscience. Law never made men a whit more just, and, by means of their respect for it, even the well-disposed are daily made the agents of injustice. A common and natural result of an undue respect for law is that you may see a file of soldiers, colonel, captain, corporal, privates, powder monkeys and all, marching in admirable order over hill and dale to the wars. Against their wills, eh? Against their common sense and consciences, which makes it very steep marching indeed, and produces a palpitation of the heart. They have no doubt that it is a damnable business in which they are concerned. They are all peaceably inclined. Now, what are they? Men at all? Or small movable forts and magazines at the service of some unscrupulous man in power? The mass of men serve the state thus, not as men mainly, but as machines, with their bodies. They are the standing army, and the militia, jailers, constables, posse comitatus, etc. In most cases, there is no free exercise whatever of the judgment or of the moral sense. But they put themselves on a level with wood and earth and stones, and wooden men can perhaps be manufactured that will serve the purpose as well. Such command no more respect than men of straw or a lump of dirt. They have the same sort of worth only as horses and dogs, yet such as these even are commonly esteemed good citizens. Others, as most legislators, politicians, lawyers, ministers, and office holders, serve the state chiefly with their heads, and as they rarely make any moral distinctions, they are as likely to serve the devil, without intending it, as God. A very few, as heroes, patriots, martyrs, reformers, in the great sense, and men, serve the state with their consciences also, and so necessarily resist it for the most part, and they are commonly treated as enemies by it. How does it become a man to behave toward this American government today? I answer that he cannot without disgrace be associated with it. I cannot for an instant recognize that political organization as my government, which is the slave's government also. All men recognize the right of revolution, that is, the right to refuse allegiance to and to resist the government when its tyranny or its inefficiency are great and unendurable. But almost all say that such is not the case now. But such was the case, they think, in the revolution of 75. If one were to tell me that this was a bad government because it taxed certain foreign commodities brought to its ports, it is most probable that I should not make an ado about it, for I can do without them. All machines have the friction, and possibly this does enough good to counterbalance the evil. But when the friction comes to have its machine, and oppression and robbery are organized, I say, let us not have such a machine any longer. In other words, when a sixth of the population of a nation, which has undertaken to be the refuge of liberty, are slaves, and a whole country is unjustly overrun and conquered by a foreign army and subjected to military law, I think that it is not too soon for honest men to rebel and revolutionize. What makes this duty the more urgent is the fact that the country so overrun is not our own, but ours is the invading army. It is not so important that many should be as good as you, as that there be some absolute goodness somewhere, for that will leaven the whole lump. There are thousands who are in opinion opposed to slavery and to the war, who yet in effect do nothing to put an end to them. They hesitate, and they regret, and sometimes they petition, but they do nothing in earnest and with effect. Even voting for the right is doing nothing for it. It is only expressing to men feebly your desire that it should prevail. A wise man will not leave the right to the mercy of chance, nor wish it to prevail through the power of the majority. There is but little virtue in the action of masses of men. When the majority shall at length vote for the abolition of slavery, it will be because they are indifferent to slavery, or because there's but little slavery left to be abolished by the vote. Unjust laws exist. Shall we be content to obey them, or shall we endeavor to amend them and obey them until we have succeeded, or shall we transgress them at once? Men generally, under such a government as this, think that they ought to wait until they have persuaded the majority to alter them. They think that if they should resist, the remedy would be worse than the evil. But it is the fault of the government itself that the remedy is worse than the evil. It makes it worse. Why is it not more apt to anticipate and provide for reform? Why does it not cherish its wise minority? Why does it cry and resist before it is hurt? Why does it not encourage its citizens to be on the alert to point out its faults and do better than it would have them? Why does it always crucify Christ and excommunicate Copernicus and Luther and pronounce Washington and Franklin rebels? If the injustice is part of the necessary friction of the machine of government, let it go, let it go. Perchance it will wear smooth. Certainly, the machine will wear out. If the injustice has a spring or a pulley or a rope or a crank exclusively for itself, then perhaps you may consider whether the remedy will not be worse than the evil. But if it is of such a nature that it requires you to be the agent of injustice to another, then I say, break the law. Let your life be a counter-friction to stop the machine. What I have to do is to see, at any rate, that I do not lend myself to the wrong which I condemn. I know this well, that if 1,000, if 100, if 10 men whom I could name, if 10 honest men only, if one honest man in this state of Massachusetts ceasing to hold slaves were actually to withdraw from this co-partnership and be locked up in the county jail, therefore, it would be the abolition of slavery in America. For it matters not how small the beginning may seem to be. What is once well done is done forever. Under a government which imprisons any unjustly, the true place for a just man is also a prison. Where the state places those who are not with her, but against her, it is the only house in a slave state in which a free man can abide with honor. If any think that their influence would be lost there, and their voices no longer afflict the ear of the state, that they would not be as an enemy within its walls, they do not know by how much truth is stronger than error. I have paid no poll tax for 6 years. I was put into jail once on this account, for one night, and, as I stood considering the walls of solid stone, 2 or 3 feet thick, the door of wood and iron, a foot thick, and the iron grating which strained the light, I could not help being struck with the foolishness of that institution, which treated me as if I were mere flesh and blood and bones to be locked up. I did not for a moment feel confined, and the walls seemed a great waste of stone and mortar. I felt as if I alone of all my townsmen had paid my tax. I saw that the state was half-witted, that it was timid as a lone woman with her silver spoons, and that it did not know its friends from its foes, and I lost all my remaining respect for it and pitied it. Thus, the state never intentionally confronts a man's sense, intellectual or moral, but only his body, his senses. It is not armed with superior wit or honesty, but with superior physical strength. The authority of government is still an impure one. To be strictly just, it must have the sanction and consent of the governed. It can have no pure right over my person and property, but what I concede to it. The progress from an absolute to a limited monarchy, from a limited monarchy to a democracy, is a progress toward a true respect for the individual. Even the Chinese philosopher was wise enough to regard the individual as the basis of the empire. Is a democracy, such as we know it, the last improvement possible in government? Is it not possible to take a step further towards recognizing and organizing the rights of man? There will never be a really free and enlightened state until the state comes to recognize the individual as a higher and independent power, from which all its own power and authority are derived, and treats him accordingly. A state which bore this kind of fruit and suffered it to drop off as fast as it ripened would prepare the way for a still more perfect and glorious state, which also I have imagined, but not yet anywhere seen.